From multiple post-facto locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steven McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I too make nice games. We're back from the 2024 Game Developers Conference, and with us, we've brought back two interviews from Midwest Games, Alyssa Wallace, and Limited Run Games, Audie Sorley. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start. Okay, so listeners will have just heard, or recently heard, part two of our GDC yes. content. This is part three, but it's a weird one, because we're back in the cities. It is now weeks later.
Yeah, it is.
Not too many weeks. Not too many weeks later.
It's kind of hard, because we just did all this GDC stuff and we're tired.
Also, I've been bedridden this whole time.
Yeah.
I did mention in my little cut-in in part two that I did get sick, actually. I made it all the way back to Minnesota fine. And then, of course, I live with one of the patient zeros. So I then got sick. And because of the way I get sick, which is like extreme, I guess, you can hear it in my voice. So that's news for me. So I don't know what day it is. I don't know how long anything has happened, what's going on. But we're going to talk about some of the long form interviews that we did, which we were going to put in these episodes. But we just said we didn't want to cut them down too much, and they kind of deserve their own space. So that's what this episode is. So, Steven, tell us a little bit about, you know, us getting these interviews and doing them.
Yeah. So we first talked with Alyssa from Midwest Games, and that was a really enlightening talk. It was pretty cool because, like, she really went into details and, like, the goals of Midwest Games and what they're doing as a publisher.
Yeah.
That I think was really fascinating. I thought it was really cool. I was glad to hear that. And then the second interview we had was with Audie and from Limited Run Games. And that one was more about their engine that they're working on and, like, a lot of the specifics about why they're doing it the way that they're doing it and, like, working with different developers.
It was a little bit of a stretch for us to take that interview. Because we weren't really sure what angle it would be for our audience, but it ended up being really good. And especially at the end, had a lot of really good comments that I think our audience will really appreciate. So that was pretty good. And those were the longest interviews we did at GDC, so we figured let's stick them in an episode.
My name is Alyssa Wallace, and I head up operations for Midwest Games.
We're a Midwest podcast focused on the developer experience. Midwest Games is a new publisher focused on developers from the Midwest, right?
They're focused on underrepresented developers.
Okay.
Very much looking at developers in the Midwest. We have signed developers in the Midwest, but we're also signing people from areas that are not typically found in the ecosystem of having a publisher, like New Mexico or Mexico. We have Duck Paradox, which we launched last week. The developer is a student in Germany, and he's from Mexico. So we are really looking to build up the ecosystem in the Midwest and also making sure that when there's a game that needs representation that wouldn't normally hit someone's radar at a typical publisher, we want to be there for them.
Okay, so that kind of answers my next question, which is like what you're doing at an event that has developers from all over the world, which is that it serves your interest. Talk a little bit about discovering that focus, because as a company deciding that, okay, we're putting it in our name, we're Midwest Games, but at the same time, we want to have a slightly wider mandate than that by definition. Talk me through that decision-making process.
Right. So Ben, our CEO, when he had the idea for this company, it was because of the fact that there was no ecosystem in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It does not exist. And there are some developers there. There are no publishers there. And so the first idea that he came to the investors with was, let's build an ecosystem. So because there is no ecosystem, there aren't a lot of developers making games in the Midwest exactly. Yeah. We are now finding them. But when we first launched, we were like, how do we, you know, we have to build a slate and maybe it's a little bit more than just that. And I think for him, he sees that creators are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We say great games can come from anywhere.
Yeah.
Or great games come from anywhere. And so that was important to him when he created the company. And in building that ecosystem in the Midwest, we're supporting other people who are in areas of their countries that are not necessarily served.
Mm-hmm. So does that inform the scope of the projects you work on?
So because we are a startup,
yeah,
and we secured some great funding initially when we launched, that is what dictates the, you know, the type of games that we sign.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking for indie games that are, for the most part, under $500,000 in development or what they need. Most of our games are far below that.
Yeah.
And we're coming in, they've already finished the game, and they need help with localization, QA, marketing,
mm-hmm.
the services that a developer shouldn't have to focus on. The developer should make a great game, and we want to come in and take it over the line and take it to the consumer and make sure that game gets as much exposure as possible.
Okay. So it sounds like you have a vested interest specifically in the Midwest ecosystem.
Yes, 100%.
What exactly does that mean? Like, if you're getting... if you're finding games from people who are outside of the Midwest, how does that benefit the Midwest ecosystem?
So we are building a publisher in the Midwest, in Wisconsin specifically. And so that supports the ecosystem. We will be, as we expand our portfolio of games, if they're not specifically from the Midwest, that allows us to hire people who don't want to leave the Midwest. We want people to stay there, right? We want those people to be able to have jobs in the area they live in, whether that be Wisconsin or the surrounding states. That's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. So not to answer Steven's question, but to me, that also implies things like support studios, localization teams, porting houses, which there isn't also a huge infrastructure of in the Midwest. Is that sort of ancillary services of the game industry that a publisher deals directly with, is that on your radar as well?
Yes. In fact, our localization team is based in Wisconsin.
Okay.
So we focus on how can we find those services to mm-hmm. support us that are based in the area. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So enough high level company mission stuff. I want to hear about your day to day.
So my job as head of operations, I refer to that as the unsexy stuff.
Uh-huh.
So the people who, like Chris, who runs product, and Jen, who runs marketing, and Ben, obviously leading the company, they're doing God's work. I mean, they're like, you know, Chris is finding the games. He's evaluating the games. He's talking to developers. I think his meetings here are back to back with developers looking at what people are creating. Jen is making sure those shine to the consumer.
Yeah.
Are we finding the right audiences? How do we get to them? Who's going to love this game? What influencer is going to be the best fit and, you know, help us reach the right audience for that game? And then Ben is talking to investors and he's talking to partners and all kinds of people. My job, which was your question, I'm sorry, it took me a minute to get around to
it. Context is valuable.
But the context is important to me, is I am doing the, like, I created the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I make sure the contracts go out. So if Chris signs a letter of intent with a developer
mm-hmm.
and they sign it and we're like, okay, we get to go to long form now, I make sure that the long form gets done. I'm helping with some platform thing, like setting up our sales. We're a small team. There's 7 of us.
Yep.
So we all wear a lot of hats and I try to fill in wherever I can be helpful to the rest of the team.
Right, right. It's like all those big sort of, you know, pillars of a company. None of that matters without the glue to hold it together, which that sounds like what you are.
Well, I think Ben is that. So I can't take that.
This doesn't have to get back to him.
No, I know. But to me, I'm just going to keep the trains on the track.
Sure. Our audience is developers, and sizable of them are from the Midwest. And from areas that don't have a lot of industry, the audience that you're describing worldwide. So talk directly to them. What kinds of games are you looking for? What is the first step for someone like them to approach you or a company like you that has a similar mandate?
So Chris Klemecki
mm-hmm.
who is on our website. You can find his name and picture on MidwestGames.com. He has some posts on LinkedIn talking about what steps publishers take in looking at games and what developers need to make sure they come to us with. For example, if a developer is making a mobile game, that's not a fit for Midwest Games. We are focused on PC primarily. We will have some ports to Switch and Xbox, you know, and possibly other platforms, but primarily we are PC. And so if a developer is working on a game that is outside of our scope, then it doesn't make sense. And so the research for that developer, for you, dear developer, is that you want to find a publisher who is publishing games similar to yours or in the same area, not necessarily genre. We are not focused on any one genre at Midwest Games. So we want to have a broad range of types of games. And so our focus is, how do we find them? How do they find us?
Mm-hmm.
And learning and doing research as a developer on who would be a good fit is really, really important. Yeah. And Chris is doing a great job at giving that information to potential developers on different posts and different things that he's said. And then looking at our website, looking at the games we've announced, the games that are being highlighted on our website, there's a submission area on our website to submit a game. That is the best way. You know, I've met some of my friends who are like, well, you know, we really want to, can you submit our game? I'm like, well, can you please submit it through the portal, like through the website? Because that, then it's on Chris's radar.
Yeah.
And Chris can track it. He can make sure everybody has been contacted after submitting the game. I hope I'm answering your question.
Yeah, I think that a lot of developers, there's this sort of skittishness about like, how do they approach that process? How do they make the right first impression? And there's a lot of historical advice, which is, it's who you know, you have to have those relationships. But I think more and more indie publishers have the form on the website. And I think sometimes a developer feels like, is that just going to go to a junk box?
No, Chris is really looking at the games. Mm-hmm. He really watches what they send in. You know, obviously, if there is some sort of a pitch deck, if there is some sort of early footage, you know, early gameplay or a demo, all of those things matter.
Yeah.
I'm not him, so I don't know if he needs every single one of those pieces.
Sure.
But I think if I'm a developer and I want to put my best foot forward, then I want to make sure I'm doing that. That said, a lot of people will want to wait till it's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And part of our job, Chris's job, is to guide that developer in finishing the game to make sure it's optimized for providing the best experience that they have. We're not trying to change anyone's view of what their game should be. We want to help them deliver the best game possible.
Sure.
Is it possible for, I'm curious about like developers who are in the process of like building out a game and they've like designed it and they created a pitch deck, but they don't have the resources currently to fully build out a game or even fully build out like a prototype or vertical slice of the game that they're working on. Do you have any advice or anything that you would be looking for that would like convince you that these developers are still worth your time?
So Chris may have a different answer to this.
Okay.
Ben may have a different answer to this.
Okay.
I would say to that developer, have you participated in a game jam? Have you tried to move it along and help, like gotten your team together and tried to push things forward so that you have maybe not the full vertical slice, but you have a mechanic or you have something that helps Chris evaluate your game? You want him to love it. You want our team to love it. It's not just Chris, right? But I mean, Chris is the first line into the company, a first person that is going to see your materials. So I think that's important, is do what you can. We talked to a lot of students last night at our event who were so excited to meet us and understand that we want them to submit their game. They're like, oh, we could submit our capstone project. Yeah, you could submit your capstone project. Absolutely. You know, get it to the point where either it's ready to release or it's ready to be seen and evaluated, that you're really proud of it, even if it's not completed.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, what I think developers are looking for, like, the right answer to these questions, but I think what we're hearing from
you... Am I giving the right answer? Because I don't think so.
Well, well, what we're hearing is that there isn't one right answer, right? Like you sort of say, you're like, well, you know, like, you don't necessarily need a vertical slice, but you also wouldn't say no to one, I suspect. And I think developers are looking, are like, what would disqualify me from a thing? But correct me if I'm wrong, but the answer is there isn't really a one way to pitch it, right?
Right. And I think people disqualify themselves.
Sure.
I think it's scary.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary to say, I'm going to approach this company. Midwest is getting a lot of notice,
yep.
Right? People are talking about Midwest. It's exciting what we're building. We're really happy that we're able to be bringing or hyping this ecosystem in the area. So that's scary. Mm-hmm. But if you don't try, then nothing will happen.
Yeah.
Right? And so I've talked to a couple people that are friends of mine and said, submit the game. I have nothing to do. I'm not the one that's going to evaluate the game.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't submit it, no one will.
Right.
And we may not be the right publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And so find a company, a publisher that is doing the thing that you as the developer, as your audience, is doing. What is similar? What games do you love? Who published that? Try to find someone who will tell you what the path is in that company. I'm just here to talk about Midwest, right? But another publisher may have a different path. I was talking to somebody earlier today about their greenlight process and how some publishers' greenlight process, meaning the greenlight process is how do they decide what games they want to invest in or what games they want to move forward with and have a relationship and publish. I heard that some companies, some publishers have a very data-driven process.
Mm-hmm.
Some companies, which means they'll take whatever you say. I don't know, because we don't do this, but that publisher may take the materials and do some research with consumers. Other companies may have tastemakers, like we have Ben and Chris, right? Like, what do they feel is going to work in the market,
right?
And we may come up with a combination of those as we evolve as a publisher. But right now, we are looking at everything that comes in. We are looking at what's happening in the market, what's doing well, what genres are, you know, succeeding, where do we feel like we can make a difference for that creator and help them, succeed. We want them to succeed.
Okay. So it sounds like just like doors are open. There's, you know, submit your games, people.
Yes.
So then my last question to you is, about the capacity of the company. What is the target? Or rather, what are you currently thinking about this year, next year, the year after? How many games are you publishing per year? And what is the goal, say 5 or 10 years out, that how many games do you want to be publishing each year?
I don't know that we have an answer to that.
Okay.
I would say when Ben launched less than a year ago,
mm-hmm.
he hoped to sign 4 games in the first year.
Mm-hmm.
We've signed 6
okay.
in the first 8-9 months. So we are thrilled that we have exceeded that goal because of the games that came in.
Yeah.
And so for 2024, we're still signing games that may be already finished, but they just need the marketing piece.
Mm-hmm.
That's happening right now. I mean, there are contracts in place right now where we're like, oh, we could still get this game out this year. This game's amazing. And we're able to make that happen. Going into 2025, we have games signed for 2025. We will be signing more.
Right.
We will be signing games for 2026. So we want to be successful as a publisher. And our games need to sell for that to be a reality for all of us.
Yeah. So you ended up signing more games than maybe you'd hoped for.
Which is fantastic.
And is that a function of the fact that because a lot of those games needed only marketing support? Or is it a matter of like, you're dipping into the red a little bit because you find enough things you're excited about?
I think it's the ability of our funding to allow us to do that because we want to take a lot of swings at the bat. Yeah. We want to make sure that we have a lot of opportunities to succeed for these creators. And so we're being careful about the amount of budget that we are assigning to these games. And we're not signing really, you know, a couple of really expensive games. We're signing more games that are not super expensive because we are going to see how it, we're new.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, people aren't looking for a Midwest game. I mean, I hope they are, by the way. But I mean, the other than the people that listen to you and people who know who we are, the general gaming public doesn't know us yet.
Yeah.
We are building a brand. We are building a publisher of games that people are going to want to play. And so we will have a portfolio and people like at some point, hopefully very near future, they'll be like, well, I played Duck Paradox. I got to go play Lullaby of Life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that will hopefully happen. And so the more opportunities we have and the more games that are in our portfolio, the better chance we will have to add more games. And so, you know, you asked about 5 to 10 years. I want to have a healthy portfolio of games for many, many years to come.
Right.
Beyond 5 to 10. And all that depends on how we do as we launch these first games and the team grows, our portfolio grows and all that. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm answering.
Yeah, I think that it's the there's always the you who knows, right? Like, well, how things are going to go. But it sounds like you're building a company that's going to make the types of games at the scope that you're targeting now, maybe a little bigger, maybe a little smaller. But you're not thinking this is the first step towards, like, you know, publishing AAA scale games.
I don't think that's on our radar.
Yeah, you're building a sustainability for the existing model rather than building towards another.
We want to build an ecosystem of game development, game publishing business in the Midwest.
Yeah.
That's our goal.
Wow, that was enlightening.
Oh, was it?
Inspiring.
What was your favorite part?
The inspiring parts.
Oh, sure. Of course. Of course.
The inspiring parts. Ellen, you weren't there. You haven't heard it yet.
No, but it feels like I haven't heard it yet.
Yeah.
But I'm sure, okay. I'm sure it'll feel like I was there when I get to listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's where we talk about something that we want our listeners to do.
Uh-huh.
But they're already doing it. They're listening. I guess they could do more if they haven't come and joined the Discord or followed social media or followed us on Patreon. But you know what? Just glad you're listening.
Aw, that's sweet.
Very sweet. It's a real soft touch. Sometimes we come down hard on the listener. We're like, hey, do this for us, please. But here you're like, you know, you're doing great.
Yeah.
A number one. And if you'd like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's more available to you.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
We are a nice games club. I feel like this part of the podcast is maybe the meanest we get.
Actually, it's pretty accurate. Yeah.
Trying to temper that just
not
a hair.
Not this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not this time. This time we're being 100% nice.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, speaking of things you haven't heard yet, we have our second interview of the episode coming up with Audie Surley from Limited Run Games, all about Carbon Engine. Let's get right into that.
You mean I have to be professional and actually know what I'm talking about?
No, that's never a requirement.
It isn't.
Yeah.
So let's start. Just introduce yourself and what you do at Limited Run.
So I'm Audie Surley. I am the producer of internal developments at Limited Run, and that basically accounts for most of the production on the Carbon Engine, our emulation solution, but also our, you know, new developments like our set and games like that.
So I'm really interested in Carbon Engine.
Okay.
And for a couple of reasons. One, it's like a unique, there's nothing else like it, right? But it seems to be built from things that do exist out there, right? Like it's to an outsider, it looks like a bundle of emulators.
Right.
So describe kind of literally what it is and maybe the misconceptions or maybe what people are assuming right about it.
No, you're kind of right in the sense that these are feature people have probably seen before in emulators and such.
Mm-hmm.
But what Carbon Engine is it's a modular system that allows us to
rewrap classic games on modern systems. So, and then do that officially with the development partners. To say our partners, Konami, we give them a chance to take their back catalog and actually repurpose that on modern systems easily, without having to do, you know, research and developments for months just to get this up and running. We built a modular system that can easily detect what system we are targeting, which system we are emulating, and then prioritizing that with accuracy and options. So that's where kind of the features come in, right? That it's not just enough to take a classic game and put it on Switch, for example, and project it on screen. That's not necessarily how people remember those games. So it's also about kind of figuring out the best options, the best features, and custom making that experience for them to make it as accurate as possible.
Right. So the sort of classic emulator experience for a user, with a legally obtained ROM or whatever, is
always disclaimer. Always legally obtained.
That classic experience is, fiddle with the options, including screen filters and aspect ratios and color palettes and stuff like that. Mm. And so it sounds like that those are all available in your system, but you sort of tailor them. This isn't a whopper, right? It's not have it your way. It's the developer is tuning it to the experience that they want to deliver on a modern system.
Yeah. So what we do is we always have open communication with the developers, the original developers, in terms of kind of what features they think are essential for today's audience, because these are younger players that don't come from, say, you know, I'm old, but like I grew up on Commodore 64 and NES and these things, so I got used to how those felt. Younger players, not so much. So for example, in our engine, we have base features such as save states, of course, so that people can save and load at any time in game, but also rewind. So like if you make a mistake, we can easily just push a button, go back. And then you have things like screen filters and things like this, just to kind of customize that experience visually.
Yeah.
Because some people are very accustomed to a CRT screen, like myself. So I prefer that things look a little bit closer to an old TV, where some other people know, like, to stretch the game across the HDTV. I don't know why they would do that, but they do it. So that option is there.
Okay.
And yeah, like you say, we talk to the developers, the OG developers, a lot, and just kind of, here's our base features, but what else can also be tailored into, say, you know, a Rocket Knight Adventures situation? Like, what do you think is essential for your audience today that you built up? What should be in there? The quality of life? How do we raise it together?
So as something built out within Limited Run, it's really also a developer relations story. And Limited Run does the publishing for these projects. So how does that determine how a consumer sees it? So when they buy a game that is made in Carbon Engine, how forward is Carbon Engine as a consumer-facing product for the user, as a badge of trust or something, particularly because it's under the banner of Limited Run?
Right. So, I mean, this is something that has to be built up over time, and I think lately it's been growing a lot. It's the quality of our titles, right? The quality of our output, because like you say, this has grown within Limited Run, who is a physical publisher, known for collector's editions, and here we are opening a new development branch. And basically what we just did is that we got the best in the community. We have Modern Vintage Gamer, Dimitris Giannakis, who's a famous YouTuber, but also an excellent programmer. He handles a lot of the emulation. I myself come from Digital Foundry, the YouTube channel, so I have a lot of knowledge and just general thoughts on how a game accurately gets portrayed on screen. So it's just a matter of kind of, it's not just enough to start this development, but it's also finding the right people to understand how is this done properly for consumers to enjoy it. And I think it's been working out pretty well. I mean, we released Trip World recently. We announced Rocket Knight Adventures, Rip City Girl Zero, and the feedback is always just that people, a lot of young people, never played these before, but they really enjoy it, kind of feel it's fortunate that we can do this now.
Yeah. And so, this may be outside your department, but as a tool, is this something you'd be considering, like, white labeling for other publishers or developers?
That's always a thought. There's nothing concrete I can talk about there, but anytime you build something that is modular like this, the thought is always like, well, how can this help the industry? And Limited Run has always been a company that wants to further and help the industry. You know, we started by helping indie publishers get their games physically out there, make the best collector's editions we could, help them make revenue by doing direct consumer. And so Carbon is built on the same philosophies in the sense that if this is a tool that we can see the industry can use to help developers bring back their back catalogs, these games are historically important. You know, this is game history, and I always like to say that we're preserving history, but we're also making history, because we are putting these games out again for the first time in 25 years, sometimes even further than that. So if this is a tool that can help the industry, that's something Limited Run is always looking at.
Okay, so I know that you're working on Shantae 2, correct?
On the Game Boy Advance?
That's what we're really here for. Yeah. I'm really excited because I'm a big Shantae fan. I wanted to hear like that process in particular about like preserving an unreleased game, because that's not done very frequently. No. And I'm curious like that process and how you interacted with WayForward to get that to happen.
Right. So I like that's a process that I wasn't necessarily like direct with.
Sure.
But in general, like you say, that's not something that happens often. And that's, again, goes back to my previous point. Like, this is history. And the video game industry has not always been the best at preserving their own history. So source codes, for example, very hard to get a hold of, which is why we use emulation a lot of times. With Shantae, luckily, WayForward is an amazing partner. And I think this is something that's been seen in magazines back in the day. Like Shantae 2 on GBA was always something that like kind of existed in the conversation of Shantae. So eventually Josh Ferrer, Star Boss, who was really into just game preservation, was kind of like, this can only happen one way, and it's that we do it, that we help fund this, we help develop this. Let's find what's out there and let's finish it. And that was really the thing. You know, this is not a game that was fully finished but shelved. This is something where we had to find the remaining source code and then have Matt Bozon come back and finish the development. So, and that requires a lot of additional funding. That requires a lot of tools that, for the most part, those tools, the SDKs and things like that for those consoles are gone. People did not keep those things.
Right.
But Matt did. So we got very lucky. But that's something that, again, Limited Run is always interested in looking at opportunities where if there are games that have not been released, or if there are ideas that have not been released or done, we'd love to be in the conversation of helping that happen. And we did the game Trip World DX. And that was an original Game Boy game from Sunsoft, Japan. And when I was put as a producer on that, and I was looking through the Japanese development files because we got scans and documents from Sunsoft because they kept their archives. And I was just flicking through, reading whenever I could, and I noticed in those development documents from 1991, I think it was, there was color assignments to the characters and some of the backgrounds. So I asked Sunsoft, was there a plan for a color version? Because this is years ahead of the Game Boy Color coming out.
Yeah.
And they tracked down the original developer of Trip World, and he said, I always had color in mind when I developed it, but Game Boy was a black and white system, monochrome really, but you know, it didn't have color, but in my mind it did. So what we did then was we offered that chance for him, what if we develop a new version of this game for Game Boy Color, for the hardware, and we put this color to use that you wrote down, those notes, we take all that and actually make it. And he was like, absolutely. So if you play Trip World DX, you can play the original Game Boy, a monochrome version, but there's also Trip World DX, which is a Game Boy Color version of that game that runs on Game Boy Color hardware, which also allowed us to put another cartridge for Game Boy Color that runs on that hardware originally. So that was something where that was not a canceled game. That was not, you know, a lost game in a sense. That was an idea that we found in development documents from the 90s and asked the original developer, do you want to come out of retirement and do this with us? And he loved it. So, again, that's where we come in and make history rather than just preserving it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I imagine a lot of folks back in the day had a particular image view of what their game was, even when they couldn't make the hardware have that happen, right? So, like, being able to bring that back is really cool,
right?
That's awesome.
And that's something I try to do in general
because as a producer on these games, I also curate a lot of, because we always have museums in our, that's again, when we do these re-release of classic games, what's important? Well, context. Why was this game important? And how was it important back then? So we always include museum modes where we either do video interviews or scans, everything we could get our hands on, really. So every game I work on, I always try to sit down and look through those original documents to see, like, is it just simply memory call-ups and some sketches in this? Or is there more details there that tells a different story that we can actually continue telling or finish up, like in Trip World's case?
So what's the natural limit to something like that? Because I can imagine your imagination can kind of go kind of wild with, like, wouldn't it be cool if we added this? Wouldn't it be cool if we tweaked this? Or, oh, I heard a rumor that this was always intended this way. What if we realized that? Do you kind of have to hold yourself back? Or is there just enough natural barriers to kind of, like, let only the ideas you can manage get through?
Yeah, you kind of answered your own question. I'm very happy you did, because that means you know your stuff. So the original hardware is the limitation we need for that. Of course, like any other creative process, you will pitch things without just, like, within the technical limitations we have set for ourselves, that can't be done. And that happens all the time, but that's a natural, that happened back then too. But that's the beauty of doing, for example, with Shantae 2, with Trip World DX, is that we have that natural technical limit. And that keeps the authenticity too, because I think if we took the idea of Shantae 2 or the idea of Trip World DX and said, well, let's colorize this game, but it runs now in Unity, and we rebuilt it from scratch, most likely there would be enough subtleties or even big glaring things that were just like, well, it's not the same game, and it doesn't feel exactly like I imagine it. But when it actually runs on the original hardware, there is the authenticity that comes with it, because that is the natural limitation of the game.
So I want to talk a little bit about modern hardware features. So I'm, you know, things like input remapping, or in the case of the Switch, motion controls. You know, do you allow yourself to, and again, the limitation is the hardware, right? But do you allow yourself at least to give the player some customization there? And are there times where you find yourself thinking, like, wow, this big box we're playing in, and we can't really use all of it?
So we always want to have enough features and all the options that customizes a player's experience and consumer's experience. The problem we face a lot with emulating a classic game like this is that changing button mappings isn't necessarily just a matter of, like, well, the Switch input is here, but the original game calls up this button. The original game might have a lot of visual feedback or UI elements and things like this. And both from a technical aspect and also from an authenticity aspect, I'm not always super comfortable just changing things into new icons and things like this. And also, the button mappings on a Super Nintendo game, on a Game Boy game, is kind of laid out as the developer intended. And sometimes, even though people really want the shoot button to be on Y rather than B or something like this, it's kind of just like,
all right,
well, that's the way they want you to play the game. So that's a slippery slope sometimes, but it is absolutely something we're always looking into, is incorporating button mappings. But we'll still be project to project that something like that will be evaluated.
I guess in the same vein, like accessibility with respect to that, I button mappings are important for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's an argument that you're preserving the original artist's intent, but also the original artist's intent might not have put a lot of effort or consideration into accessibility.
Competing interests.
It has competing interests. Yeah. So I'm curious, like, your thoughts with respect to that, and how you're, like, approaching it from an accessibility perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where it comes into quality of life and just also modernizing something. And generally, as I said, like, it's a case by case. So we evaluate it as we go along. It's also on the back end, like, having our engine to just have the ability naturally through game to game. Because our engine is continuously being built. With each title, there are new features, and that we bring those features onto the next project, and we patch it back in as we go into the older ones. So I'm sure eventually, kind of across the board, button mappings is something we'll reevaluate. But so far,
our thoughts at least have been just that the natural setup of the controls have been natural enough, even for, because we do test the game obviously with blind test and focus testing, so we do get some feedback regarding that. But yeah, it's like I said, it's always just going to be case by case, and so far those cases haven't been in favor of doing button mappings, but it is something that we are working on.
Speaking of working on,
yeah,
as you build out for each project, that seems like a really efficient way to develop the project. So what's still missing? What are the big headline things that no project has asked for yet, but you really want?
So the things that I really want to improve upon is visual clarity and also options. So right now we have for example, a CRT shader or filter, but I want different monitors. I want a large selection of how people can experience the game, because back in the day, nowadays we just use HDMI, it's direct digital output, but back in the day you had RF, you had S-Video, you have composite, you had all these different ways of seeing the game. And games were developed with these different things in mind. Some games were developed specifically with composite in mind. Other studios used a PVM with like a super clear pixel density. So I want all those options in there. So that's kind of where I'm looking at improving the engine. It's just kind of, it's entirely visual, but I think that stimulates a lot of people's experience, because having raw pixels on a big screen, it's not how it was always meant to be seen. In general, it wasn't actually meant to be seen at all.
What?
And so I think there's a loss in art by just having a game projected in a big screen like that. Because when you look at something like Symphony of the Night and you look at the portraits, when you look at that just for pure digital output, you know, it's all pixels and whatnot. But when you have that color bleed of a composite, you see a lot of details that were not there before by having those colors and details bleed together, like the red eyes on Dracula and things like that. So I want to make sure that we have enough options to always retain that.
Yeah.
So that's from my point of view, like kind of like where I want to improve. From a programmer's point of view, which, you know, they would probably have to answer that for themselves, but I know that button mappings, like customized button mappings, have been toyed with. Emulation accuracy, new system support, because that's also something we keep as we build partners. We build their library, and there's always like suddenly there's a game from a system that we haven't yet tackled, which comes with its new challenges. But as soon as we tackle that challenge, that system is now supported to the next project, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just in general,
yeah,
Carbon Engine is just something we keep building upon. We want it to be the ultimate solution for classic video games.
So when it comes to the actual emulation, are these open source emulators? Are you developing them in-house? Is it from a wide range of sources? How are those projects credited or displayed within the games itself or within your documentation?
And so some of the emulators are actually coded in-house by Demetrius. And some are licensed. And generally, you'll see that in our credits, because obviously we show full licensing. We go through that round. And that's very important because, you know, respect the GPL out there. You know, there's always a lot of articles about just kind of that having been bypassed or just overlooked, because emulation for a long time was kind of a gray area. So it's only in the recent years that we kind of seen it become the de facto solution for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so you will always see our licensing for emulators in the credits. And they're on our PC versions. I think we can even go into a license tab and see them there.
Cool.
So,
yeah, I think that consumers of these games, these re-releases, are probably also just interested, apart from sort of the developer angle, I think a lot of just average everyday people would be curious to know all that stuff, right? Like sort of just how the sausage is made, at least to some degree. So, like you say, emulation being a gray area,
yeah.
Where are we at? We're not up to GameCube yet, are we? Like, what's the legal limit of what's allowable?
The legal limit is just support from developers. I mean, I don't know where the legal limit really is. I mean, because emulation for us, I mean, the legalities come from our official partnerships, right? So when we talk to, for example, Konami, this was the full support of, this is the solution we have.
Yeah.
It's our own code. It's our own emulators. or licensed emulators, which they can go in and look at the source code or look at the GBL and figure it out. So I think most have opened their eyes and seen that, like, rather than letting their back catalog just sit and become kind of relics, they can become new classics again. So we have never really faced that issue, which is really cool because, you know, I've been around since early 2000s, and emulation for me for the longest time was always just kind of a ROM list, you know, and a weird emulator with some kind of nefarious name. And that was kind of it. And it's cool to have been part of legitimizing it because this is really, you know, Carbon isn't the only solution out there, nor should it be. We should have competition. We work closely sometimes with our competition.
Yes, too.
But it's really just cool to see the industry itself is opening their eyes to emulation, seeing that, like, they can help preserve the history that all these companies made.
Well, okay, so the last thing I want to ask, Limited Run has a reputation amongst indie developers as a place you can go to, you know, to get your work on a shelf, right? That's kind of its brand. So when it comes to Carbon Engine, I mean, there are a lot of developers out there making Game Boy games, making NES games. Is that, because I could see the argument for saying no to that, but is that something you've thought about?
Yeah, I mean, so far we've done mostly the, you know, developers like Sunsoft and whatnot, but we're always open to the idea that Carbon is not just simply, Carbon is a solution for everything. And I personally love NES homebrew and Game Boy homebrew. I did a lot of, I'm old and I'm European, so I did Amiga stuff back in the day. So I think it's really cool just to kind of be able to bring this out on consoles and with the solution. So if there was a cool, like, Game Boy homebrew, for example, that could be felt by Arvid, I would totally be into that.
I mean, this is lots of great information. We're really pleased to hear it. Is there anything that you want to tell an audience of developers about the project or about Limited Run?
Well, about the project of Carbon Engine, I hope developers use our solution here to look at classic video game design and discover that timeless game design is timeless. There's a lot of things that can be learned or inspired by these classic games. I think a lot of misconceptions about retro gaming is that, you know, it's NES difficult or it's, you know, it's aged badly or things like this. We hear it out every day, but I think in general there's always merit to game designs, and I think there's a lot of ideas that can be taken from them. And even if you don't think they're executed perfectly, let that be a springboard into your own design mythologies to see how you can improve it. This is a completely aside from Carbon, but I was the producer on Arzette, the Jewel of Faramore, which was a reimagining of the Zelda CDI games, which came out last month. And that was the idea of taking, I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with this Philips CDI. Yeah, but that was a dream of mine and developer Seth, of just taking what we felt was the base gameplay loop and mechanics of those Zelda games, but putting them in modern context, you know, giving it the power it needed to actually do what it set out to do. Are they actually bad games? Are they actually worthy of being like the worst games of all time when you look at them outside of just the technical limitations I had from the CDI side?
Yeah.
And so far, the incredible response, because that was a huge success for that game, so I was very happy after 3 years of dying for that game. But what we discovered is that people have gone back even to those old games and kind of figured that, like, there was something to this. There was a game design here that all the ideas were there to make a great game, but they couldn't execute it on the hardware. Or, yeah, those ideas were cool. They didn't execute it quite right back then, but our set took that idea and did it right. So I think for developers, I think Carbon Engine can be something like this, where we give them finally an option to play it easily on modern hardware and let that inspire them. And maybe by playing Turf World DX, the old Game Boy games, we finally see a game in a few years that follows that kind of open-ended mythology that they did back then, a platformer without an objective. You know, I would love to see someone kind of, hey, what does that mean to them? And see the inspiration from Tripwald come into play.
Right, right. Because yeah, right now everyone's like making their souls like with roguelike elements, right?
Yeah.
But more inspiration, right?
More inspiration and more timeless design. That's what's so important to video games. It's just we follow trends all the time, but trends die. But timeless game design does not die. And that's why we always go back to the Super Nintendo, Super Mario Worlds and whatnot. It's not just the nostalgia of it. It's the loop of it. It's the mechanics of it that are timeless. It's that responsive, reflective feel of taking that controller and doing those acrobatic movements so fluently, for example. It's the going around fighting secrets on this stage, good level design, whatever it is that makes those games timeless. Take inspiration from that, but make your own concept of that. That's what I really love.
So that was a really good interview as well. Ellen, surely yeah. You'll agree.
Uh-huh. Yeah, amazing.
Uh-huh.
100%.
Well, it's been a couple of weeks since GDC, and this is probably going to be our last thoughts on it in a while. But we talked a little bit about the games that you and I, Stephen, were both excited to play. I don't know if it made it into the episode yet, but we talked about what we were looking forward to playing because it came out on that Friday.
Yeah, I don't know how I could have possibly recorded the whole thing without talking about how excited I was to play Dragon's Dogma 2.
Yeah.
I have since played Dragon's Dogma 2, and I want to talk about Dragon's Dogma 2 extensively.
Oh,
so this outro will not suffice.
Gotcha. Okay.
I want to do like three different topics on Dragon's Dogma.
Oh, that's interesting.
So look forward to that.
I was really excited about Princess Peach Showtime, which I was too sick to even pick up. For most of the first week I got back. And then I put in like an hour with it. And I really like it. But I just I don't have the energy. I didn't want to make it a chore. So that one.
Sure.
So I too will talk about that more extensively in a future episode.
Yeah.
Probably.
I had the same issue when I got back. You know, I was extremely excited to play Dragon's Dogma 2.
Yeah.
But I was still sick and you know, Mark hadn't gotten sick at the time. So I was like,
I missed my 1.5 day window is what happened.
You did. You did. I got home and I was like, I can't play this game. I really want to play this game, but I can't play this game. And so I just let it sit for a couple of days. And then I took Monday and Tuesday off because I was still feeling kind of sick.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm feeling a little bit better. Maybe I should try it. And then I tried it. And now, you know, that's my whole thing now. Yeah. I'm a Dragon's Dogma 2 player. So,
you know, sick days are days for video games. But when you're an adult, you realize like, oh, no, it's just an excuse for video games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did we fool ourselves for so long in our youth?
Oh, gosh.
All right. Well, that is our show. And that concludes our GDC coverage. But you know what? There is 40 minutes of bonus material on the Patreon.
40?
Mm-hmm.
We can't leave this episode without saying, 40 whole minutes of stuff we had to cut out of the three episodes that we recorded and produced and delivered to you. So it was a big year. And it was really good stuff. And and like it is every year, different from the year before. We've never had a GDC coverage play out the same way twice, which that's I don't know if that's a good thing, frankly, but it is kind of fun to discover how we handle things year in and year out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, optimism, Ellen. I like it.
Yeah.
For show notes and links on today's interviews, go to our website, nicegames.club. You can visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about things. But real quick, we kind of want to get your feedback on that. We're kind of posting mostly to threads now. We're off Twitter. I think we're pretty comfortable saying we're not going back there anytime soon. But also threads is kind of still building, and threads now can let you federate your account into Mastodon. And so we want to hear from our listeners. Where do you want to see Dale's cat pictures? And also game dev information, let us know, because we're sort of still figuring out that strategy. So let us know on the Discord or reply to us on threads or send us an email, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. If you didn't hear me mention it earlier, support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes and all that bonus crap. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord. If you didn't hear me mention that earlier, and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at visual world building with our pal Laura Underwater. But that's it for this week. And so, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
going to cut this part out.
Magic of podcasting.
All right. Cool. We're done.
All right.